Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Driveway.
Oh, madness.
All right. So we'll see you on the other side, brother.
All right, matey. Thank you.
And in the meantime, here's the late, great Lowell George reminding you to...
This is a top to, you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11,
oh,
11,
and most of
11,
the
and
amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everybody. Welcome aboard Fox Up here for a Tuesday night or Wednesday morning or Wednesday afternoon, all depending on where you reside on this beautiful brown marble, such a, that it still is. And I tell you, I was just having one of those moments where, you know, I really miss QNN, Bob. I miss that extra, you know, 2 minutes between one show and another to, you know, grab a cup of coffee, you know, do a couple things. Man, it can be tight between that roll another one and my bit, but, you know, hey. Bob says, no fruit cup. Yeah, but Bob, you don't realize that I'm sitting there thinking, ah, yes, I'm a terrible cigarette smoker, and all during the horn section, I'm going, oh bloody hell, I left my filters in the other part of the house. So during the break, I go running to that other part of the house. No, they're not there. And then I come back in the studio and I look way out in the backyard by the table where I was standing outside in the sun earlier. There's my filters. Oh, my intro music is running. I'll just run out there and grab them. But I made it. That's what's important. It's kind of chaotic day. I'll talk a little bit more about the, World Youth Day stuff that's been going on. If you're listening to the Horn Section, I mentioned that these ridiculous annoy laws that they had. Annoy. You will not annoy. How vague is that shit? They've been struck down. But while I kind of get things together here, let's do the music bit. And I don't know if I've played this before. I could have. You know, it's not like I keep a list of the things that I've played. But I just dig this stuff. Just give me a second here. But I dig Everlast. I really dig what he did. Now I kind of like that. You know, I kind of dug House of Pain as well. But what he created later, really cool. Why does John like it? Well, it's got acoustic guitars in it. That helps. And I don't know. It's just some really interesting lyrics and ideas. And you know, the first album, there's actually a picture inside where you can actually see. And yeah, one of these tracks is kind of, you know, for the world, you say. But kind of in between the House of Pain thing and him starting his solo thing, he had a mad heart attack, needed bypass surgery. And if you actually if memory serves me right, when you pull out the CD from the debut record, there's actually a photograph of his bypass scar. You know, and he was pretty young at the time. And kind of woke him up. And set him up to kind of do some risks. And supposedly he was demoing some of this stuff and, like, sticking it as the, you know, the answer music on his answering machine and sending it to some of his rapper friends. And all of his mates are, like, going, dude, you got to do something with this, you know? And acoustic guitar was something, as far as I understand, this is all coming from memory. I haven't researched this at all, but if memory serves me correctly, you know, guitar was something that he'd learned when he was young, and then when House of Pain came, he kind of, like, didn't play guitar at all anymore. So during his recovery from surgery, he got his hands back on the guitar, and it became the instrument of his composition. So I really kind of dig the mix of styles. And so first, I'm gonna do the non World Youth Day angled one first. We'll do a track called Ends because I think that this song speaks volumes. Yeah, it just speaks volumes. You know, everyone, you know, people will do whatever it takes to get their ends, and you know, there's something to that. So. And then we're going to come back and we're going to do a track called Black Jesus that I really love. But we'll start out with Ends. And I believe that this one is off of the debut record. I have no dates. I have nothing. Just I thought it was a good song. I didn't have much time to get this to Bob. So this is what we're going to do. So Everlast with the Ends. Roll it, Bob.
Ends. Some people were robbed their mother for the ends. Rats snitch on one another for ends. Sometimes kids get murdered for ends. So before we go any further, I want my ends. I knew this madman Bill didn't have a dollar. He was tall, material, Ivy League scholar. Had a PhD, had an MBA. Now he's waiting tables cause he's rent to pay. The company's downsizing, inflation's rising. Can't find a job, it's been kind of stress. Doesn't even feel the effects when he says. Forgot to count how many times he's been blessed. When he falls off track, starts smoking the crack. And once it hits his brain, starts to chain react. Sells his shirt off his back, shoes off his feet. He's losing all his teeth, now he's out in the street. All of a sudden it's like Jesse James trying to stick up his holy watches and chains. But he's from business school and is nervous with the tools. So he ends up on his back in a bloody pool for the ends. Some people were robbed, they
shopping sprees, get up on her knees. And if you hit her with the keys of your crib, you acting funny. Come home one day, find her counting out your money. Wetlands all the way to the Apollo. If you broke, she's spitting. If you're rich, she might swallow. But the ends, some people were robbed in my love. Snitch on one another. Oh yes. Sometimes kids get murdered. Oh yes. So before we go any further, I want my hands. Kids was on their job. They was tougher than leather, like Reverend Ron. DMC, they was totally gone. Holding weight, going downstate. Stacking mad chips, pushing fat whips. Fly jewels and clothes, got no job. And then one disappeared and one got robbed. For the hands, some people were robbed that month of. For the hands, rat snitch on one. Sometimes kids get murdered.
All right, Bob, if you like that one, you're going to love this one. Now, this is off of the, I think it was the second album called Whitey Ford Sings the Blues, and this one's just kind of directed at all those folks that have come from all corners of the world to participate in World Youth Day. You know, if Christ the Man did exist, I guarantee you he wasn't no white guy. So with that, here is Everlast with Black Jesus. Roll it, Bob.
They call me White Devil, Black Jesus. Heaven closing, hell freezing. Egos tripping, Crips keep dipping. Blacks keep flooding, Crips keep dripping. Time keeps slipping, and I keep falling. I can't see, but I hear him calling. Ball is falling, players playing. Haters fighting, righteous praying. Don't bring it now, you keep making. You keep taking, should ones keep shaking. No time for faking. I'm mean, I ain't chopping no pies, just rising like cream. If you dig in the sea, you feel it alive, throw your
Albums. I would suggest, if you haven't really heard, especially Whitey Ford Sings the Blues, the second one, which I don't think did as well. How common is that for my favorites list? The one that didn't do Big Guns tends to be the one that I'll really like. I don't know what that says about me, but hey. And as Bob says, the na-na section is kind of infectious. Oh, yeah. And there's a few other tracks in amongst there that are, you know, fairly earwormy as well. Good sing-along kind of stuff. And, you know, say what you will about white rappers, but I think some of them get it. And, you know, and I think that's a cool thing. And, I mean, like, if I had the liner notes in front of me, like, the list of, like, great hip-hop artists that, you know, are on it and helped out is just, like, you know, miles long. But where am I going? Okay. Gene sent me this, and I think that this is a really, really good idea. Now, you know, over in the States, we talk about the, you know, we talk about cafe standards, you know, fuel efficiency standards all the time. And when I first moved to Australia, The little sticker on a new car that gives you the fuel efficiency was worded completely different, you know. You know, we had the miles per gallon thing in the States. So I was expecting when I got here to be like kilometers per liter. No. Here, they show you how many kilometers you can go on 100 liters. So it, or, nah, or, yeah. Now, it gives you much more an idea of the quantity of fuel to a fixed distance. Sorry, it's actually how many liters of fuel to 100 Ks. That's what it is. Now, there's a piece here that Gene sent me from ecogeek.org that talks about kind of just, you know, miles per gallon is a stupid measurement. And I have to agree. It says we tend to have bad measurement systems here in the U.S. Yeah, like imperial stuff. When the rest of the world has gone all metric, even the UK. We tend to have bad measurement systems here in the US. We've got a temperature scale where water freezes at 32 degrees and boils at 212. It's 0 and 100 for the rest of the world. And none of our measurements are compatible with our base 10 numbering system. 12 inches in a foot, 5,280 feet in a mile. I mean, come on. So it should come as no surprise to you that measuring vehicle fuel efficiency in miles per gallon is about as effective as a city's population density in square miles per person. The reason is simple. When we want to know how many gallons we'll save, but what we're getting is how many miles we can go. This might seem like a small difference, but displaying miles per gallon and gallons per mile immediately shows some huge flaws in our current system. And they have a little scale here. 15 miles per gallon equals 660 gallons per 10,000 miles. 20 miles per gallon is 500 gallons per 10,000 miles. So just 5 miles per gallon better efficiency, you have used 160 less gallons per 10,000 miles. I mean, this is huge. 30 miles per gallon is 330 gallons per 10,000 miles. 45 miles per per gallon is 220 gallons. And if you actually get to something around what I think, you know, minimum standards really should be, 60 miles per gallon, 160 gallons per 10,000 miles. This gives you a much better gauge to understand and really get a grasp on the volume of fuel that we use. And I think it makes for a much, much better understanding of the savings when you have a more fuel-efficient car. The article here continues, and I really should quit the author. Who is it that wrote this thing? Just, you know, momento as I get there. Oh, written by Hank Green. How convenient. He continues on after that little list saying, now, obviously, the most fuel-efficient car here is still in the 60-mile-per-gallon car. And that's fantastic, but increasing the mileage of a 15-mile-per-gallon car to 20 miles per gallon saves as much gasoline and carbon as doubling the mileage of a 30-mile-per-gallon car to 60 miles per gallon. So, I mean, you know, it's not going to take much in changing, in adjusting the minimum to really bring down fuel use. And he continues, but to the consumer's eye, the difference from 15 to 20 might not seem all that important. One might even go so far as to say that they would see it as insignificant. If they're going to buy an inefficient car, what does it matter if they get an extra 5 miles for every gallon of gas? This, in short, is why the Chevy Tahoe Hybrid won Green Car of the Year this year, and why it may seem like the best way to save gas is to make small cars more and more efficient. It's obviously much more important to work on the big cars first. Not only is a gallons per 10,000 mile system more accurate in terms of efficiency, it's better for the consumer. It shows them exactly how many gallons they'll be burning, and from there, it's only a quick multiplication to get yourself a big, scary number for your gas bills. Of course, if history is any guide, switching the units will be no easy task, but the next time you're at a dealership, maybe you should bust out your calculator and figure out how many gallons per mile you'll be getting. And I think there's definitely something to this. And the first comment comes up going, I disagree. Efficiency is usually in terms output per input, and miles per gallon is easy to understand because it's in the same way, the output being miles traveled and the input being the gallons of fuel inputted into the car. And comparing how far two cars can go on 1 gallon of fuel seems easier to understand. I totally disagree with this comment. And it also makes, and you're able to do the reverse conversion much easier when you have it done this way to start with. So if you actually want to break it down to the other way, it's easier to do the math. But hey, you know, it doesn't surprise me that the minute you start talking about changing the way we count something or the way we measure something, that you're going to end up with resistance. Because, you know, America does not do change well. You know, and aside from, about the only good thing that I find with the imperial system anymore is the use of feet and inches. And only because it, when you work within that system, you're able to do divisions of thirds and fourths easier. But it seems like the rest of the world has figured out how to do that as well in the metric system, so I think it can't be that hard. And I'll tell you, there's nothing more annoying, and this is really going off on a tangent, to have a bicycle that's half metric, half imperial. Constantly have to go, oh, I need that. No, is that, that's, no, not that second. Try that socket set. Crap. Why can't it all just be one thing? But anyway, I think that's a good idea. I really do, because I think it gives more impact to the usage, not just what you're getting out of it, but actually, overall, what you are taking from the limited supply that there is. I actually agree with the piece. Now, another piece that Gene sent me, and he sent this to me probably might even be last week by now. It's almost a week old, but it really, it's not like it's outdated or anything. We're losing species at just an alarming rate. And, you know, we talk about large animals, whales, larger predators, polar bears, things like that. But there's the other end of the scale that's really suffering, and this is the smaller animals, the tinier animals. Now, I've spoken before about the dead zones in various places off of, various coastlines where fertilizer runoff and other things have just created these dead zones where there isn't any protoplankton or ectoplankton living anymore. And so, I mean, we're talking about the very bottom of the food chain. You know, there are big things when you lose big predators because smaller predators end up running rampant. But here, when you're talking about smaller life forms, you're destroying the beginning of the food chain, and everything depends on everything below it. You know, we depend on everything below us in the food chain. Well, the BBC has a piece saying, fallen tiny animals a disaster. Experts on invertebrates have expressed profound shock over a government report showing a decline in zooplankton of more than 70% since the 1960s. Nothing's changed. The tiny animals are an important food for fish, mammals, and crustaceans. Figures contained in the Department of Environmental, Food, and Rural Affairs document, Marine Program Plan, suggested a fall in abundance. Charity Bug Life said it would be a biodiversity disaster of enormous proportions. They said it could have implications for creatures all the way up the food chain, from sand eels to the seabirds such as puffin, which feed on the fish. DEFRA described the Marine Program Plan as one of the department's high-impact programs, reporting directly to the DAFRA board and used to guide policy. And DAFRA is that Department of Environmental, Food, and Rural Affairs. Bug Life Director Matt Sardlow has written to Rodney Anderson, Director of Marine and Fisheries at DAFRA, praising the level of information in the document, but also expressing the organization's serious concerns. In his letter, seen by the BBC Scotland News website, Mr. Sardlow said, the disappearance of butterflies, moths, bees, river flies, and other small animals is an environmental tragedy. But despite this experience, we are profoundly shocked to read that zooplankton abundance has declined by about 73% since 1960, or about 50% since 1990. This is a biodiversity disaster of enormous proportions. The graph shown in the report charts a steady decline in zooplankton from 1990 to 2006. Bug Life Scottish officer Greg McAdam said climate change could be a factor. He said zooplankton is the basis of many food chains in the marine environment. Without them, it is going to cause problems further up the chain. Well, a lot of the areas that are suffering this is where we have these dead zones in the ocean. I mean, the Gulf Coast off, the United States is a mess, and it's dead. It's dead. Nothing's living in it. That's just the way that it is. And, this stuff really, this is what really starts freaking the crap out of me. The bee thing. I was talking about Haagen-Dazs a couple of weeks ago, and I think I was actually getting into this one. Maybe I got knocked off air one day. But if you check out Haagen-Dazs' website, they have another website, and I think it's called Save the Bees, from memory. SaveTheBees.com might be. And Haagen-Dazs is seeing this problem, and they're realizing that, a huge amount of their flavors of their ice cream. I mean, this is actually getting to the realities of climate change and what's happening to the planet affecting business. This is the stuff where I want, stupid politicians to wake up and talking heads that go, oh, we're going green to play stuff. It's going to be a disaster for the economy. No. If we don't clean it up, it's going to be a disaster for the economy. Maybe cleaning it up and changing our act might be a disaster for certain people's economies, but those economies are no longer viable with what we know. Chuckle in the chat room. Zooplankton, I must have missed that enclosure. I'm not sure, but I think that might be the culminative word for ectoplankton and protoplankton. I'm not sure. But, you know, like Haagen-Dazs have set up this major, major, major website to educate people on what is happening with colony collapse. And, I mean, really, you know, we talk about a lot of things when it comes to our changing climate. You know, drought, stronger storms, all that kind of stuff. But one of the quiet things that's going on that is so unbelievably frightening is this loss of smaller life forms. Now, you know, outside the world of Frankenfood from Monsanto, most of the world's food relies on bees for pollination. I mean, this is just, there is no argument about this. This is not something that you could put on a ballot and have people vote on and whether or not this is actually factually true. So, you know, there's farmers and big companies like Haagen-Dazs who are looking and saying, you know, if we don't figure out what's going on with this colony collapse situation, our business is screwed. So they have taken this on in their own way. And it's a beautiful website. You can fly this little bee around and go and get little bits of information about what bees actually do and how absolutely crucial they are to the survival of this planet and feeding all of us. And Cobwebs is saying in the chat room, they've not had bees this year like past years. And we've seen some of the same thing here. In fact, you know, Gail has selected certain plants, certain flowers, you know, complementary plants to the veggie garden with a specific purpose to try and attract bees. And the colony collapse thing is really, really scary. All over the planet, you know, this isn't localized to one place, but all over the planet, you know, established bee colonies suddenly disappear. And there are many theories going around, and some of them are really starting to point at genetically modified crops. And that very possibly, and we don't really know the answer yet, but we're starting to see more and more of it, that something happens to the honey, like it goes off, or it no longer, you know, for some reason it makes them all just disappear. Either they flee or they all die. We don't even know. It's not like there are bee carcasses everywhere. It just seems like that the bees just vanish, and it's really disturbing. Okay. There's a link here in the chat from Treble. Something about cow urine bees. Okay, I want to see what this is. All right. Okay. From a website called GardenMandy.com. That's just been sent my way in the chat room. They've got a post here. I have not seen anything about this, but this is interesting. Saving the bees. Is cow urine the key to colony collapse? Huh? Trying to imagine a world without bees is not an easy task. Sure, you wouldn't have them buzzing around every time you ate lunch outside, or your kids would be safe from painful stings during summer adventures, but would we really notice if they were missing? Would it really affect your life if tomorrow you woke up, turned on the news, and realized that all the bees had just disappeared? The answer is yes. Your life would be drastically affected if they were to disappear. Considering that bees are responsible for about 30% of the food supply in the U.S. alone, I'd say that we depend on them more than one might realize. The honeybee population has dropped by half over the last 50 years. When many are baffled by the incredible decrease, others contribute it mainly to mites and pesticides. Not only would we lose fruits and vegetables that honeybees pollinate, but the leafcutter bee and alkali bee, which pollinate alfalfa, are also in danger. This poses a major threat to the meat supply. A new hope for the bee population. There have been recent reports out of India about the use of cow urine to control microbial diseases in bee larvae. Yes, you read that correctly. Researchers have been spraying the eggs with cow urine. Hoy. Which is not only controls microbial disease during the rearing process, but also makes the colony work more efficiently by removing the unhealthy larvae. The cow urine seems to be an efficient, safe alternative to the medicines that are currently used to treat microbial disease. While this sounds a little unconventional for many, it could be a major step in helping increase the honeybee population. Well, I mean, that's kind of cool if we found a way to help deal with some of the issue, but really, what is the cause? I really think we need to figure out what's causing the collapse. It really is one of the more frightening aspects of the changes that are happening to this planet at the moment. And unfortunately, I think this falls into one of those things where, you know, mankind and its arrogance, you know, think that they don't depend, we as humans don't depend on anyone else. Like, we're so far advanced than everything else that we don't depend on anything. And that's such an incredibly ignorant and arrogant attitude to have about this world. And, you know, I think it was only, you know, maybe a century ago that the average person would have seen something like this and realized that there was probably a problem. You know, if, say, you know, you had been collecting your seed year after year after year and suddenly didn't quite have as much seed as you had, and you noticed that the bees weren't around, and you understood that bees pollinate things. But, you know, we're so teched up, and we're, you know, I've said it before, we've become so disconnected with our food supply that we can't do the simple mental gymnastics. And, I mean, we're not talking a complicated move here. That this really could be a problem. I can't reiterate it enough. You know, and would an outfit like Monsanto just be like, you know, kind of like going, oh, yeah, baby. We'll just have to produce all the seed. Because nature can't do it anymore. We might have even broken it. But we'll never admit that. Because we're a nice agro business. Horse pucky, to quote Susan. But yeah, you know, scary, scary, scary stuff. So, you know, for those of you that have your gardens, whether it's just a little flower bed, whatever, you know, check your seed catalogs when you're going to plant next time and look for things that are known to attract bees that are supposed to be really bee-friendly plants. Because I really think, you know, not just think. I'm of the understanding that we need to do what we can to try and pump the population back up. You know, as they're saying in the chat room, we have screwed up Mother Nature. We have screwed up Mother Nature. Something fierce. You know, and probably, yeah, and use heritage seeds, absolutely. I'm big into that. But, you know, there are all these things going on, and we keep thinking that technology is going to pull us out and not without us having to change what we do. I'm going to switch gears slightly because something that I was afraid of seems to be happening. Now, the new Labor government here has just released their carbon cap hermit system details. I haven't had a chance to read it. However, always in the back of my mind, you get people in politics who say, we're going to bite the bullet and do the hard yards and do something about this. So, you know, here in Australia, just in the United States, all you see on TV is everything all about, what are you going to do about petrol prices? What are you going to do about petrol prices? So, you know, we know that this carbon cap and trade and permit thing is going to kick in. And, you know, part of the conversation, you know, is you know, gas for the car and the diesel for the car going to be part of that? That'd be really hard on families, as I. And the opposition here kept saying, oh, but we'll pull 5 cents off the excise tax. And it's just been this absolutely stupid argument over nothing. When petrol's gone from a dollar to now pushing $1.70 to $1.80 a liter, 5 cents of excise makes no difference in the big picture. And that excise tax is obviously used for services. So I was of the opinion, yes, everything should be under the new carbon tax. If you pollute, you pay. Period. Don't care who you are. It's everyone's responsibility. Well, it seems that the Labor government lost a bit of its spine, and some of what's been released in the plan that for every cent of carbon tax that ends up being tacked onto gasoline and diesel, they're going to reduce the excise by that amount. So robbing Peter to pay Paul. Now, I understand that this was something to deal with politics in general, which is what really, really pisses me off about the modern day. Is it, you know, it's not a, you know, there's compromise, and then there's, I don't know, how do you say it? Then there's not having the spine to stick to your guns and actually explain to the people why you're not going to cut the excise. Right? So, I mean, we're talking about different taxes here. And one of the things that they got to fix here in Australia is for some stupid reason, diesel has more excise tax than anything else. So the folks that are buying diesel, the truckers and everybody else, you know, and some people who bought larger cars, you know, recently said, you know, we've read up and diesel seems to be a bit cleaner than the big fat petrol version. So they at least tried to do something at least leaning, but then they get whacked. You know, a fuel that actually technically is cheaper, but the excise on it is makes it higher than regular petrol. So it's all a bit silly. So I'm really disappointed that they, but I can see why they get forced to do this, because you end up having these little wedge issues brought up. Just like I was talking about in the horn section with Bob. There's a much bigger issue here, and the plan needs to be all-encompassing. It has to just deal with everything. But because of short-term political fear, they end up backing down on something that if they actually got out and explained the damn thing right, people would come to understand that they're just screwing themselves. And the whole idea, well, one of the ideas of actually putting these dirty forms of fuel under a carbon tax is to actually try and get people to limit their consumption. So if you're going to negate the increase, you've just killed half of what you're trying to do. The other half of it is those taxes should then be going into supporting alternative cleaner energy. Now, the thing that's really kind of, the other thing that's angered me is now the central point of the whole carbon cap and trade thing is going to be sequestration. Yes, yes, yes. The coal company bosses and the lobbyists got down to the Labor government. And most of the R&D money is going into carbon sequestration, something that is still a frickin' pipe dream. You know, not long ago, they did a they were setting up a test run of a sequestration system. And so they have the big media thing, all the cameras are there with the guy from the electrical generation company, and he turns on the switch, and everybody goes, yay! As soon as the cameras are off, the boss comes down and turns it off. Says, that's enough. So what was the whole point? Ah, spin. Ah, saving face. Ah, look. Pay attention to this part, but don't look too closely. We've just made it look like sequestration is real, when it's an absolute load of horse shit at this moment in time. And I was really happy earlier during Bob's show. Nanette and Neela were posting links about this wind power petition for West Virginia. I've signed. I think it's a really good step. And I would hope that they can get this thing on the ballot to try and save. What is it? Is it Coal River Mountain that's actually the last one in that area that's even standing? Hasn't had it blown to a moonscape? You know, and see, here in Australia, we've actually done a little bit more than some other nations when it comes to this stuff. So, I mean, we've already started making the steps. Why are we going to be all half-assed now? Why are we going to do something so silly? And this is where, you know, I actually get, I'm really pissed off at the opposition over this, because they've been screaming out 5 cents of excise tax removal, saving money, all that crap. They've ended up undoing the possible good for cheap political points. And I mean, I want a strong opposition to help strengthen legislation, not weaken it. But because all they have at the moment is to just be reactionary, you end up with this bullshit argument that's gone on for like 6-8 weeks, and the government ends up bending. And I, like I said, I understand it, but I still disagree with it. I still think it's dumb. But hey. Now, you know, I mean, there's going to be a lot of debate on this yet. You know, I mean, this, they've just released what the proposed policy is going to be. So, you know, maybe they put this in just trying to get the rest of the package through. But I just don't, really, really upsets me. Now, before we run out of time, as you all know, Gail and I have been working on, you know, cleaning up our act, as they say, in our home. You know, we've done the renewable energy thing, we have the human powered clothes washer and the veggie garden and, you know, all that kind of thing. I came across last night, let me see if I can find this. Now, I've seen these before, but I hadn't actually seen plans for one. Now, unfortunately, in this house, because we're renters, we're stuck with an electric cooker. And, you know, that's unfortunate. And electric water here. So we don't have a whole lot of control over that. So all we can do is buy into the renewables and try and be as efficient as we can. Now, at a great little blog called homegrownrevolution.com, they have instructions on how to build a rocket stove. And Gail and I decided that we're going to make one of these. An outdoor secondary stove made out of a few bricks, a bit of stovepipe, and it's designed to give you very, very high heat very quickly off of just twigs. No logs needed. So it's basically, you know, a brick box with a small concrete footing, and inside it is an L-shaped bit of stovepipe, and you fill the rest of the chamber with ash as an insulator. And you end up with this little shelf at the front where you can just stack your sticks. And you turn it on, you light it up, and you instantly have, very quickly, really good cooking heat. And, I mean, you can build this stuff out of, you can build one of these out of, you know, pretty much reclaimed bricks. And, you know, the only thing you have to go and buy is a couple bits of stovepipe and an elbow. And maybe a little bit of quick pour concrete. You know, to do like an 18-inch by 18-inch slab. So we've decided we are going to build one of these. And it's something that we'll probably do as summer comes closer. Because, hey, you know, instead of going and getting, you know, the schmicky side burner attachment to the gas barbecue, how about having a brick stove that runs on twigs? Because we have this mountain of lantana that we cut out. That week by week we stuff in a little green bin and make it go away piece by piece. Well, we probably got enough sticks back there to keep us in cooking wood for like an entire summer. And because of the design and the way it creates this kind of high velocity kind of convection system, it said that it burns really efficiently so that it burns really clean. And if you build it right, the emissions are extremely low. So that's the next step. That's the next step in greening up the home/studio over here. And I think it's going to be a great one-day project that we'll probably get a whole lot of pleasure out of using. So check it out. Go to homegrownrevolution.com and just search for Rocket Stove. And the guy shows how they built theirs, and he's got some links to videos on how to build a couple of different ones. Even one of them shows how to make your own super lightweight clay and wood chip or sawdust bricks for insulation. To do, instead of the stovepipe, you can do it with heat insulating bricks. You know, make them so light that they'll float in water. But, you know, this is, I think it's a really cool thing. And, hey, you know, if the grid ever goes down, hey, can still cook. All part of the idea that, you know, I keep fearing that, you know, if we don't really seriously, you know, pull our finger out of our collective behinds, sometime in my lifetime, this whole just charade of a system could come bloody crashing down on us, you know? It could just come down, and suddenly all the stuff that we depend on won't be there anymore, and we don't know how to do stuff anymore. So, you know, I mean, it's kind of what we're working on. You know, the growing your own veg, which I still think is one of the most fantastic things I've ever been convinced to do. Just so gratifying, so unbelievably gratifying. And you know, I mean, there's plenty of people in the chat room that do the same thing. I know Bob's broken ground. Nanette is just, she's the mad woman. when it comes to the veggie garden, she could feed an army. She does all that canning stuff. Gail and I gotta get into that as well. But you know, I mean, this really, you know, I think it's got to be the way that we go. You know, and because it's gonna get to be too hard. It's gonna get to be too expensive. You know, we don't get off this oil standard stuff, we're not going to be able to get crops from farmer to market, let alone, because we depend on fossil fuels so much just to farm, growing your own is going to be the only way to go. And there was just a thing last night talking about, you know, the potato really is about to make its comeback, because when it comes to energy used to create food, it creates more food for energy used than any other crop in the world. Just thought you'd like that little tidbit of information. So with that, we're going to wrap things up for today. Thanks for being with us this week as I kick off another week of Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network. Tomorrow night, I got a track of the day from David from Maine. He'd wanted me to play it tonight, but I need to get a little bit of background information because it's a friend of his, and it's an interesting little R&B track. So we'll do that tomorrow night. Thanks to the bloggers and the mods for everything that they do, and thanks to Gene for the stories today. Thanks to Bob for producing. Thanks to Scott Berry at B1 Louder Productions for the music, and I hope he's surviving World Youth Day. Thanks to Ben Birch at the White Rose Society for the screening and the archives. And as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
And the sign said, long-haired freaky people need not apply. So I stuck my hair up under my hat, and I went in to ask him why. Membership card to get inside.